making it possible for me to be here in the first place. I'm going to discuss a few essentially finite pieces of quantum mechanics, in particular the mutually unbiased spaces, which were discussed a couple of times on Monday. But the focus is not on diagonoidal categories or string diagrams, but rather on just very simple matrices, which look like they're linear maps in a category of Hilbert spaces. But the idea is to, all along, while we're looking at what they tell us about these finite structures, think that they might belong in some other categorical context. So the reason is that we have motivations coming from lots of parts of physics. So for gravity, we want to consider toposes. In quantum field theory, we want higher dimensional categories, and also things like operads, props, multi-categories. And something which combines all these elements doesn't yet exist in mathematics, although they're all beautiful and seem to be somehow essential in their own right. Now, by categorified arithmetic, I mean a large subject which involves a lot of mathematics, only a few small things that I will refer to today. So things you might have heard of along the lines of not number correspondences, where you're thinking of number theory in a higher dimensional sense to classical number theory. And there seem to be close connections between some of these finite structures and things belonging to that branch of mathematics, if you like, although it's not a well-defined branch of mathematics yet. So to start with, rather than talk about the mutually unbiased bases, I'll say a few things about entanglement. And I realize it's a wide audience, so I apologize if this is all really well known to some people. But this sets the mood for what we want to say about mutually unbiased spaces. So the thing that we understand quite well, I guess, now is that if we look at the classification for three qubits, so here we have a general state, then we have a canonical measure of the entanglement, which in the black hole context of black holes is related to entropy. So I'm just going to make a couple of comments on that, but there's nothing to do with that really in this talk. So this is the hyperdeterminant goes back to Cayley in the 19th century and appears in lots of different contexts. And here what it's doing is it's just taking these amplitudes and evaluating an invariant. So that's a homogeneous polynomial. Now in the context of quantum mechanics, and here we're always thinking that we want to throw Hilbert spaces away, so we don't expect diagonoidal categories to be the ideal context if we don't want to think of the whole of Hilbert spaces as the ideal context for, say, entanglement or whatever it is. So the first thing we notice here is if we have a homogeneous polynomial, then we're really talking about projective geometry. And projective geometry, what we can do is just simply, this can be done generally here. I'm illustrating this with the most natural example. If we select one coordinate and set it to 1, then we're looking at the some affine space. And when we do that, we get something which is no longer homogeneous, but looks a bit more like an ordinary determinant. So long as we set this to 0. So if we start by looking at what we might call zero entropy, then the A111 term expressed, if we rearrange this, in terms of the remaining 6 coordinates, is actually a determinant, namely the determinant of this matrix here. Now, these components are themselves determinants of principal minors of the matrix. So this is a sort of a very natural matrix, which is nothing like a matrix in Hilbert spaces. Here our index is our qubits, so what, qubit 1, qubit 2, qubit 3. And we're not thinking of this state any longer as something quite so linear. And these indexes here are, you know, so this is precisely the way that you index the various determinants that you need to construct the matrix there. Now, we want this to be, in general, you want this to be non-zero, but just starting with that simple idea, that completely generalizes. So the correspondence here is for qubits and subsets. So notice that at some very fundamental level, we're thinking of the fact that the fact that a qubit is a 0-1 structure is the same as the fact that we're taking subsets. So in a topos, this is the very the two-element set is a very special object, which is the sub-object classifier, and the classifying functions are the maps into that set. And these are the things that are related to the fact that we have a 0-1 construction in the qubits. Now, because all along in the back of our minds, even though we're doing simple algebra, we're thinking that we want to think in terms of, you know, n categorical approaches to quantum field theory or whatever it is we're playing with, then we think that, well, probably what we're going to eventually want to think about here is a generalization of the case of sets, the topos of sets, which isn't necessarily confined to the one-dimensional case of a standard topos, but could be some higher dimensional generalization, because where the dimension is associated with what we're just thinking of as the dimension of Hilbert spaces here. So an example of this is W state, so one of the three qubit cases. And just by writing those down, these things look like they have a more natural geometric interpretation as, you know, perhaps incidence matrices, or eventually we want to understand the numbers we get out as really canonical invariants, so from cohomology theories or, you know, Euler characteristics for categories, and very nice things like that, rather than just some computation that we do in Hilbert spaces. This is just, I've just briefly mentioned, this is another thing that comes up in studies of entanglement classification. Nice graph moves, which also makes sense in the context of the dagonoidal category string calculus as well. And part of the point here is that, so one of the things that I'm going to try and say is that normally when we think about arithmetic, say in the topos of sets, we have a natural number object, but we're always thinking one-dimensionally. So if we don't want to do that any longer, we're thinking, like any category theorist would, that the numbers are coming from some kind of decategorification process. So the counting numbers 1, 2, 3 are perhaps counting the dimensions of spaces, or the number of elements in a set, or something else, even the dimension of a category. Perhaps that's sort of a suggestion that I'm heading towards you. Anyway, something that's probably not that well known, but is very basic, that we can say about three qubits. Going back, so this is in this paper here from 08, is that these are just shorthand for, if I have a Pauli X matrix, Pauli Y matrix, and Pauli Z matrix, and they're acting on each of my qubits, and I've just left out the tensor product signs here, then we can make a correspondence between the 63 elements of this group to the power 3 without the identity. So there are 64 elements to that group, and then if you take out the identity, there are 63 left. And those 63 are precisely the points, the lines, the flags, and the anti-flags for the Fano plane. Now, so that's a very nice finite projective geometry. So it's a complete geometry in a nice sense, and it's completely finite, and it captures a lot of things that we are interested in quantum mechanics. So just for those who don't know, so a flag, rather than being a point or a line, a flag here, we just have a plane, is a combination of a line and a point on the line. And an anti-flag is a combination of a line and a point that's not on the line. So, and another thing to observe here is that the Fourier transform, which is just the Hadamard gate for qubits, but we'll look at this in general in higher dimensions. So I'm going to call it F2, but here I just mean the Hadamard gate. That's the thing that swaps points and lines, because by exchanging X and Z, you can see it takes these special Z cases to X cases and vice versa. So it's a basic geometric operation, and it seems to be a very natural geometric interpretation for three qubits. So if we want to then step back again and think about how the numbers that we actually measure. So part of the motivation for this sort of n categorical approach, if you like, is that there are varied realizations of qubits or qubits in general. So we're not thinking of the numbers that we actually measure as the entire description, because it's a description of an entire class of things. So there's a kind of decategorification just in saying that when you measure something, you're actually looking at something which it might be a set, it might not be a set, but something like a set of particles. And your number is some kind of, it arises from some kind of decategorification. And I'll say quite a bit more about that at the end. Here are a few other elements in this approach that I'll just mention here, partly for those who may have heard of them before. So one thing that we saw in the discussion on the string diagrams for Dagger-Monroe categories was these spider diagrams. Now, operators and props are very important in quantum certain mathematics in quantum field theory, and these are really what underlie those spider diagrams that were important on Monday. And there are quite a few other things that seem to arise in quantum field theory, in mathematical quantum field theory, which haven't been discussed yet, but that relate to this idea of finite structures and elementary geometry for pieces of quantum mechanics. And one I want to mention is the non-commutative Fourier transform due to Kapranov and other people. So this is supposed to be related to this. So the idea of a non-commutative Fourier transform is that if we start here and we look at the possible paths on the cube, then we could take x, then y, then z, and the x, y, and z is labeling spatial dimensions. So the part of the idea of mutually unbiased spaces and playing with the Dagger-Monroe categories is that, you know, we want this real background independence. Space-time is eventually supposed to be an emergent construction, and these simple Pauli operators, or they don't have to be Pauli operators, this is defined in a much more abstract setting, are really much more primitive than the dimensions of space as you usually think of it, because they enter at a more basic level. So the non-commutative Fourier transform is an elegant kind of Fourier transform where you're doing a kind of non-commutative geometry, because these different paths are not exactly the same thing. So if we travel along x and then y and z, it's not the same as traveling along z and then y and then x. And it's n-categorical in nature, because we really are going to be filling in, whenever you see a cube, you're filling in faces and so on. So now I'm going to focus on the thing which we understand the best, I guess, so far, which is these basis structures. And I'll say a bit about these. Now, First of all, we know now how to construct these for all prime dimensions, for all prime power dimensions, which I'll say a bit about next. And then I want to say a bit about decategorification, and only if I have time will I say a little bit about stone geology, which is something that Andreas and Klaus both mentioned in the context of topos theory. If you don't know where this quote comes from, don't worry, but it's Alan Kohn thinking about a kind of set of numbers which appears to come up naturally here, as I will describe. So what's a mutually unbiased basis? So we know if we have the Pauli operators for qubits, then each one describes a set of eigenvectors, and these are mutually unbiased in the sense that the inner product here for different sets is always 1 over the square root of d, where d is just 2 in the case of qubits. But in general, d is the dimension of, if you like, the Hilbert space that we're talking about. Now, in everything that we do now, we don't ever need to write down states, because the states in each of these cases can be recovered from the columns of another set of three operators, namely the identity, the Fourier transform, and this operator. So the Fourier transform columns, so remember 1, 1, 1, minus 1, these are the eigenvectors for the x operator. And now this operator doesn't share the property that f does, which is f squared to the identity. But when you get to higher dimensions, this operator will always satisfy r to the d equals the identity. So there's something tricky about qubits, which is related to the fact that the dimension is so low. It is something you often see in geometry. When the dimension is sufficiently low, you have a special case, and then beyond that, it is quite a bit simpler. So what we normally get is that, so let's look at the Q-trick case. R3 to the 3 will be the identity. Now, in all, so to start off, just this is what happens for prime dimensions. In every case, R squared, R cubed, and so on, up to R to the P minus 1, and then R to the P, which is the identity, that will give you D matrices. And then with this one, you'll get D plus 1 matrices. And the columns will each form a set of eigenvectors for the generalized Pauli matrices of that dimension. And so this is always the Fourier operator, which is defined, yeah, just in the usual standard way it's defined. And here, omega is a cubed root of unity, and omega is always the pth root of unity. So these four matrices here are a way of writing down the generalized operators for the Q-trick case. And you can always do things in this way. So this is from the Weyl algebra, so this part is well known. So this is a diagonal operator, permutation operator, and so on. Now, this is a general formula, and this is not necessarily so well known, for this operator in all prime dimensions, where k here, because it's a circulant, so you just shift to get each row from the previous row. So you only need to write down the first row, and that's specified here for k 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So it's easy to write down what that operator is in all prime dimensions. Now, I should say, for those of you who don't know, that very little is known about these structures in non-prime power dimensions. And what little we do know seems to suggest that they fail to satisfy this nice property, which is that in prime power dimensions, there are always d plus 1 of these basis sets, such that they are all mutually unbiased with respect to each other. And now what we're going to do is we're going to look at how the prime power case relies critically on the structure of finite fields. So there's a very close correspondence. In some sense, these things represent finite fields. So in particular, this operator will obey this group law, where x and y just stand for any element of a finite field, particular to the dimension that we're working in. Now, when we multiply, say, two generalized Pauli operators together, it will turn out that we're really only using finite field arithmetic, so long as we're confining ourselves to a particular dimension and not mixing up types of qubits. Because these have so many zeros, and that's always true, we're not really using addition there. So what happens for prime power dimensions? So I just wrote down an example for the finite field on 9 elements. So that they can be expressed by these simple polynomials. And for each element, there is an R matrix. And in this particular case, in terms of a simple character formula, which I didn't write down, you can just write down what that operator should be. And you can see that it's no longer a circulant operator, but the blocks are still nice circulant operators. And that's always true. And it's always true that the Fourier transform, which will just be a product of whole lots of Fourier transform for the prime dimensions, will always diagonalize all of these circulants, you know, for all qubits. And these circulants also have nice properties and act very simply on, and what I mean here by cycle types, matrices like this, or where the shift can be more than just one across, so two across or three across. So remember that circulants are like Fourier series here, because you're taking combinations of the permutation matrices which are, and it's so this is basically what the quantum Fourier transform does. So after looking at this structure, we notice that if we just want to consider, say, certain subsets of quantum mechanics in the usual way that we do, say the stabilizer formalism, if there's in some sense a natural choice of number field which is not the complex numbers, and that is the one that we need to do, say, operations with just the operators that I've discussed so far. And so for qubits, because we have to start with F4 and not F2, so that was that weird special case where we needed the complex I, but normally this would just be the same dimension as the qubit, then, or n qubits, then this sequence here is sort of the natural choice for that segment of quantum mechanics. And the collection of all of those, if you take the appropriate limit, usually that would make the two adic integers, which is no longer countable, but it's certainly not the same. You're certainly not getting back the complex numbers. And in fact, the way that you show that certain things are isomorphic to the complex numbers involves the axiom of choice. And since eventually we do want to think about things in terms of Topos theory, we really want to distinguish between what might look like the complex numbers and what actually is the complex numbers. So the reason I'm saying that these are very simple things, but what I'm trying to say is that so far in the category theory that we've been looking at, there isn't really much of an arithmetic element. And this seems to be so crucial here in understanding these, you know, very important pieces of quantum mechanics. And in fact, the whole the history of Galois theory in the 20th century. So Galois theory, if we start looking at the way the different finite fields are related to each other, we're talking about Galois theory. And the 20th century study of that is really what led to Topos theory, in some sense. So Grothendieck's work on Galois theory, and then later work by Joyal and Tierney, and many others. I'm just mentioning a couple that you'll know, probably, on extending Grothendieck's ideas on Galois theory. And then later on, work by people of Street clarifying lots of different conditions on categories that don't necessarily restrict you to toposes, but look quite carefully at structures, categorical formulations of Galois theory, structures in Galois theory. So just a quick note here that if you combine, so if we wanted to somehow do most of quantum mechanics without using the complex numbers, then combining all of these stabilizers, we would have what's called the profinite integers. And by just tacking on the reals, which doesn't look very elegant, but there's a lot of mathematics involved in this, we get something that's called the integral Lidells. And then, so these don't have nice, simple, one-step algebraic closures like the real numbers do to the complex numbers. So there are a lot more questions we can ask about what we're doing in between and what sort of limits we're thinking about, what sort of, not necessarily a topos, but like a topos that we might want to be in to talk about these things. So that's p-adic integers. So here, I mean precisely this thing where now instead of just qubits, you could have any qubits. Well, I'm assuming prime power dimensions everywhere here, so we don't really know anything about composition of prime powers. So just a few comments. There are other pieces of evidence that we should have some more arithmetic elements in our axioms than we do. So, for example, the R2 matrix, which is the qubit case of that R operator, if we just define something, which this is related to the Euler decomposition, which again turned up in Dagger monoidal category analysis, then you get a nice Yang-Baxter equation here. Now, that funny I is again just special to the qubit case. In general, it looks even simpler than that. But the natural thing to write down here is not quite a Yang-Baxter rule in all dimensions, but a weak Yang-Baxter rule. And this is what I'm going to try and spend the rest of the talk explaining, is why this is a beautiful thing in its own right. And here P is like a permutation, and that's because the Fourier transform squared, in general, is going to be like this P operator, but shifted probably by another permutation. It's not important here. So the thing is, in two dimensions, we get the simple case where we can actually create braid representations and so on in a standard way, because the Fourier transform squared is the identity. And the reason that fails beyond qubits is precisely because the Fourier transform no longer squares the identity, and it's F4 to the identity. But you get this instead. And the point is, there is a very nice n-categorical sort of piece of work where this thing shows up. And just quickly some comments. So another thing which I'd like to say a lot about that we won't have time for is that when we move to Dagger-Monoidal categories and we start talking about the difference between Speckan's toy model and the quantum mechanical case, locality, non-locality, then in a way we're unifying sets and vector spaces, and that's something that mathematicians have their own way of thinking about these days, which is something they call the study of the field with one element. So that's actually a tremendously complicated and difficult thing to understand, but there's some analogy here to what they're trying to understand and what we're trying to do. And the point is that if you want to try and define a braid group representation using these types of operators when this is a root of unity in the appropriate dimension, normally these things will all collapse down and won't actually have a braiding. But in this context of this field with one element, you're thinking of the braid group as actually a linear group. And then you start thinking of these matrices in quite a different context, and they have operations which are very different to the usual ones. And there's a strong connection between the way you relate your braid group to things like the modular group. So remember that the braid group is the fundamental group for the complement of the trefoil knot, and there's a simple condition which makes it cover the modular group. So there's all sorts of aspects of, if you like, arithmetic mathematics, which you can somehow represent with these structures. And maybe you need some more algebraic components from quantum theory. But and I won't even bother mentioning this other example here. So this is a standard thing from quantum groups. It's very easy to satisfy these Weyl-type rules because after we're talking about Weyl algebras, but finite fields automatically give you extra rules which give you well-known quantum group type relation. Anyway, so this nice geometry which gives you a weak Yang-Baxter rule is this comes from this program of group weightification by Byers and Roland and many others, I guess. So here's our flag. And the point is we have an operation called points and an operation called lines. And this is how a weak Yang-Baxter rule arises as a geometric construction. So given this flag, the operation P will pick a point that's not the point that we had because that was part of the flag, but it's also on that line. And the operation L will pick a line. And the operation P will pick another point in the same way that I picked the first point. Now, that's like PLP. And then we want something like LPL on the other side. So LPL does something similar where I would start with a flag, but then I'm going to choose a line first, and then a point, and then a line. Now, notice that, I mean, this is, given this initial diagram from PLP, I could complete this because according to the axioms of projective geometry, there's a unique line through these two points. And similarly, there's a unique point at the intersection of those two lines. And I can, in fact, what we would think of normally is we would think of the point opposite this line as somehow being dual to that line within that small geometry. So it's the duality that's making these things look equal, although clearly they weren't equal the way we originally drew them down as PLP and LPL. And that's, so remember from our Fano plane geometry for qubits, this is quite close to what we were doing because it's the Fourier transform, and that was that P on the weak Yang-Baxter rule on the last slide, which is just the permutation. It's the Fourier transform that's swapping us between points and lines. So there's obviously a lot more work to do here in seeing whether this really is the right way of thinking about the geometry of these structures, but it's certainly the only really geometric, in a traditional sense, thing that we have so far. So I'm just going to say, to finish with, I guess, some more general comments on what we think is underlying some of these ideas. So remember that, very abstractly, the Fourier transform is, if we have a locally compact group here, this is supposed to be a hat and a double hat, then we have Pontryagin duality, and this is, you know, just the same as in vector spaces where you don't have, you need natural transformation because you really want to go to the double dual before you have this nice relation. And this is the same sort of thing here. So abstractly, we should think of the Fourier transform in this setting. Now normally, okay, we're thinking of things like U1 because we're not afraid to use reals or complex numbers, but we're demanding all along that eventually we want to do things constructively. We want to choose something like a tropos, but even just saying we're in a tropos is not good enough. We want to be much more careful than that. So we can't start with anything that just borrows intuition from the reals or complex numbers when we don't actually have to do so if there's something else available. So the point is here, for example, if we didn't have U1, but we had all the p-nth roots of unity, so we had the two added integers for the qubits, and if we have all possible prime adic integers, then that is nicely dual in this sense to all the p-nth roots of unity contained in U1. Now, you might have to give up, when you start playing with these kinds of number fields, you might have to give up some things that in ordinary quantum mechanics, like if you're just working in Hilbert spaces, you might think were sort of rather bizarre. But from a logical point of view or from a constructive point of view, then they're not at all bizarre. So there's no reason to find this sort of idea offensive. And so in some sense, you're getting close to, well, close to the real and complex numbers. You've certainly got it uncountable. You've got a very large sets of numbers anyway. And the thing really underlying this is stone duality, which was briefly mentioned by Andreas and Klaas, which is you have a very special object in these categories, namely this object 2. Now remember, we wanted to associate 2 with qubits. So we're thinking of, you know, in terms of locales or frames or something. So this is a bit more subtle than just saying it's a two-element set. But now it's not just an association coming from playing around with entanglement. All along, crucial in all the mutually unbiased bases was the Fourier transform. And the thing about this is that, okay, so there's a lot of interesting work here, but one thing I just want to mention is that we may not, because of this issue of how we, let's say we wanted to recover the complex numbers, how would we do that? Well, in a natural way, then we don't necessarily want to confine ourselves to a topos where we have, for example, a power set for the natural numbers. And there are very nice categorical constructions where you're no longer in a topos, but you're in something sufficiently like a topos, that it has all the nice properties that you might want. So this is an example of a recent thesis which really looks at those sorts of questions. And so this is a very, very abstract thing, and the question is why we'd want to generalize that to N categories. But because of this motivation coming from other areas of physics, I mean, I've only been discussing quantum mechanics here, but there's motivation from, as you know, from quantum field theory especially, to think of this dimensional hierarchy as not confining us to one category. And that means what we're asking for is something which doesn't exist, and that is something in high-dimensional topos theory. Now, there is a lot of work on high-dimensional topos theory, but it doesn't look anything the same. So there's the work of Mark Weber, for example, where instead of a map from a one-point set to a two-point set, which is your truth arrow in the topos of sets, you have... So now you're in the category of categories, and the analog would be this functor from a category of sets to a category of pointed sets. But as you can see, none of this looks anything like these simple, very, very finite sort of things that we want to think about. So in the same way that strict N categories are built up, if you like, from simple oriented simplices, then we want some finite, simple picture which has an arithmetic element, and that's somehow missing from the things that we know how to use so far. Of course, there are more sophisticated ways of thinking about these things. Whether that's helpful in this context or not remains to be seen, I suppose. So to summarise, it seems that there's a lot we can do to think about what we mean by geometric structure for the nice components of quantum mechanics that arise in, you know, Dagger-Monoidal categories, but that don't necessarily have anything to do with the string diagrams, but are more geometric in an elementary sense. And because they are, they relate to a lot more mathematics in a way that we can perhaps get a handle on in the near future. And it seems that, well, I mean, there is actually a lot of work already using mutually unbiased bases. So in particular, I would recommend work of Carl Brannen. Now, Carl Brannen has a formulation of the standard model that uses mutually unbiased bases and obviously quite a lot of other algebraic structure. But in a very concrete way, we can actually do real phenomenology potentially without having a full theory of quantum gravity because, you know, you can... So this is one well-known thing. So quite a long time ago, Yoshio Koide, founder of a simple relation for the charged lepton masses, and predicted the tau mass correctly. And this can be translated just using a Fourier transform. So thinking of the masses as eigenvalues, and it's a triplet of masses, so as we know, the generations. So the Fourier transform in general is just this emission matrix here. And the point is you can just transform that relation into a choice of parameters, and you only need two parameters. So you're translating your masses into parameters in this context of these circulant operators. And quite a bit of work has been done on that already, actually, in hadron phenomenology. Now, I mention that particularly because it's not very well known, and I think it's very interesting. Yeah, so maybe I'll stop there and leave time for questions.
Baxter rule that you showed is a consequence of automorphic action of classical eigenstates on the phase group.
Yeah, sure, that's what it is. Yep. Yeah.
So let's thank our speaker again.